But up next, a couple of brain studies in the news this week. One of the biggest mysteries of the mind is how long-term memories are formed. And a new study eavesdrops on the sleeping brain and comes up with an answer to that question. Researchers recording a rat's brain activity during non-dreaming sleep found that the animals actually replayed the day's activities nearly simultaneously in parts of the brain that process initial memories and lay down permanent ones. We'll talk about this study and another one out in the that is out in the January issue of Nature Neuroscience and what it tells us about how our brain makes memories, plus another study in the same journal that shows that humans can track a scent on the ground as well as a dog can. Now, here's something you can try at home. I'll tell you how the scientists did this. You just have to put your nose to the dirt. We'll talk about the students who actually did that, and maybe they're being congratulated these days. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Nicholas Wade is a science reporter at the New York Times here in New York. He joins us today by phone. Welcome back to the program, Nick.
Thanks, Ara.
Let's talk about these couple of new brain studies that came out this week. This first one, the researchers were looking at how the brain forms memories. What? Give us a little thumbnail sketch of that study.
Well, I think this is really quite an important advance and gives us a key new insight into how the brain as a whole works. It's based on the study of rats learning to run a maze, and we've known for some time that these the initial memories of learning a maze are laid down in cells in the hippocampus. That's the sort of structure deep in the brain, and they are recorded in what the scientists refer to as place cells, because as the rat passes each point in the maze, a different one of these place cells will light up. So you can tell where a rat is in the maze by looking at your recording systems and seeing which of its place cells is active. So this gives you a very good handle on memories, because it turned out that the memory of running a maze is played back, as you just said, when the rat pauses for a while or when it's asleep. You can see these place cells firing. Very interestingly, it's in reverse order of the route that is traveled. So you see the place cells firing again in a very distinctive a cascade, and the opposite of the way the maze was run. So that's what Matthew Wilson's MIT reported, I think it was in February of this year. And now he's looked to see if he can see this same trace elsewhere in the brain. So we've always thought that the initial memories are laid down in the hippocampus, but they sort of seem to disappear from there. And then we know that long-term memories reside in the cortex. That's the sort of sheet of shells of cells on the outside of the brain, which is the sort of seat of consciousness and higher cognitive functions. So it's been a big question: how do memories get transferred, if that's what's happening, from the hippocampus to the cortex? So in the experiment reported last week, what Wilson and his colleague Dr. G did was this time they put electrodes both in the hippocampus and in one part of the cortex, that's the visual part of the cortex, the one that deals with sight. Very interestingly, they found the distinctive memory, this sort of reverse rewind, was played both in the hippocampus and in the visual cortex during sleep. So this is the first time that we've known that the cortex also has its equivalent of place cells. So these would have been the cells, I guess, that the rat it would be the places where the rat is sort of seeing things in the maze, corresponding to the actual sort of location that's in the hypothalamus.
And so the rat is replaying this in fast rewind.
Yes.
So the fact that you're seeing this after the rat is either asleep or has done this implies that it's consolidating what it has seen into memory.
That's probably the case, certainly with the hippocampus, when the rat does this during the waking state. So what's very interesting to sort of ask about is, well, what's happening during sleep? So it certainly could be a consolidation of this memory, but Matthew Wilson also thinks that there's another component to this, and it may be, it's not simply a question of a memory being transferred from the hippocampus to the neocortex, to the visual cortex. It might rather be the cortex is trying to figure out what's going on. It's trying to make a model of the brain, and it's drawing data from the hippocampus, saying sort of what happened, what did this mean, and it's trying to create a model that will guide the rat's behavior the next day or in future.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the distinctive aspects of our brain, unlike computers that can record masses of data, but have a very hard time saying what does the data mean, our brains are very good at extracting meaning from the data. So maybe what this experiment is capturing is the cortex in the process of sort of interrogating the hippocampus during sleep and trying to sort of figure out the nature of the world outside that the hippocampus has experienced.
Mm-hmm. Could it be figuring out whether this is something we want to remember, we want to record permanently?
Yes. So the hippocampus maybe records all of the sort of raw data,
mm-hmm. like a buffer in there in the beginning,
right? And the neocortex will maybe be sort of abstracting from it just the data the neocortex figures is meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could also be that hippocampal memories are being sort of stored in a very sort of distributed way all over the cortex. After all, there are bits of the cortex that deal with vision and bits with hearing and bits with smell. So maybe the initial memories are recorded in all places, both in the cortex and in the hippocampus, but somehow rather the information in the hippocampus is essential for linking them all together.
Mm-hmm. Is the fact that the visual areas are involved mean that it's sort of watching a movie, like or what happens during a dream? You see, you know, you create some sort of visual concept.
I mean, that could be it. I mean, they just chose to record from the visual cortex, I guess, because it's a limited number of electrodes you can put in the rat's brain.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be that the cortex just has, as it were, lots of frames in the movie. But to play them in the right order with the right timing, you need the information in the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. I mean, that could be the sort of link between the two.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255, talking with Nicholas Wade of the New York Times about this interesting study with rats in a maze recording their brain activity. This study was done with rats, Nick. Do the researchers think the results possibly will hold true for humans also?
Yes, they do, because they have the same. The rat brain and the human brain have the same structures, and the down the molecular biology level, they work the same way. And it's very unlikely with something so basic as memory. It's very unlikely evolution would have evolved a totally new mechanism for us.
Mm-hmm.
So almost certainly, these findings will be applicable to people.
Let's talk about this other study in Nature Neuroscience that put the human nose to the test, where they actually had their students, who are always using these tests, actually put their nose to the ground and sniff a trail?
Right. This is the craziest experiment this year, I think. The actual purpose of the experiment was to ask whether having two nostrils just a little bit apart helps a mammal of any kind locate a smell. And we know the fact we have two ears a little bit apart helps us locate a sound, because the source of a sound, because the sound arrives at very slightly different times at the two ears. So do the two nostrils of the nose perform a similar function for us? I think the researchers thought first of testing this on a dog, but the dogs object to having one of their nostrils blocked. This is a sort of necessary procedure to make sure that you need two nostrils, not one. So they chose a more amenable experimental subject, which was the undergrads in the psychology department. I'm not sure how voluntary their participation was.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Right.
And so they lay down a chocolate scent on the ground, and they actually had them put their nose to sniff to the ground. And the surprising part is that they did as well as the dogs did.
Well, they figured that chocolate was the scent that would appeal to undergraduates. And they laid down the scent on the ground. The poor undergraduates were sort of blindfolded, and their ears were blocked off too. So it would just be nothing except smell would be coming into their brain. They had to put their nose literally to the ground. So it's not very dignified crawling along with your nose in the ground and your bottom in the air. But they managed to do it. I mean, it wasn't quite as good as the dogs. I mean, they were pretty slow at it. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't sort of deviate very far from the track, I think, or they'd lose the scent. Whereas if you follow a dog doing the same thing, the dog's sense of smell is so good that it can run fast, deviate quite a long way from the track, and still come back to it.
I can see the next episode of Monk, where he's got his nose on the ground, following the trail. Did they discover that the stereo effect was necessary?
Well, yes, that's right. So when they blocked off one nostril in their subjects, their performance degraded considerably.
It did.
Right. So
was that because they've lost a sensor? How do they know it's the stereo? Well, you know, you lose half of your sensory organ.
That's a good point. And they could follow it some, I guess, but it just made them move a lot slower, because I guess then they just had one nostril to track the scent.
If people want to watch, see this in action, they can go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have the video. It's actually a video of this. There's a link to the Nature website showing one of the study participants following a scent. Do you think there's a follow-up to this study, Nick?
I'm not sure what it could be. I mean, maybe it shows that our sense of smell is not as bad as we think it is. And we're always told how we've lost all these smell genes. I mean, mammals have a sort of standard repertoire of genes for detecting odor. And I think about half of ours have become inactivated. So I think we assume, therefore, that our sense of smell is very, very poor compared to a dog's. And it probably is for all this odor genes we've lost. But in terms of just raw performance, if you can compare us with some smell we can still detect, then as the experimenters showed, our performance is not so bad. And the sort of basic architecture of the system is still there and operative, even though we haven't used it for tracking for the last 5 million years or so.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Nicholas Wade about smell this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if we can go to the phones, get a call or two in for Nick. John in Overland Park, Kansas. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a college student, and I don't always get the most sleep. I was wondering, on the first study, whether the amount of sleep has any possible links that can be drawn from that first study to the amount of data that can actually go into long-term memory that's actually rewound and put onto the cortex.
Hmm. Good question.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't think they've done enough to sort of quantify exactly how much sleep you need to do what. But certainly this establishes a very real function for sleep. I mean, one that people had guessed beforehand that the purpose of sleep is to consolidate memories. But this, I think, is one of the first sort of clear proofs that is indeed what's going on. And interestingly, it takes place not during REM sleep, those sort of brief periods from which subjects can always report dreams when you wake them up. This takes place during slow wave sleep, which I think was a much more sort of mysterious part of the sleeping process. Mm-hmm.
There was a study out recently, I remember reading in the journals, about people who have sleep apnea having bad memories because they're not sleep. Their memories, like mine, are just gone. But if they gave them this positive airway mask to use, that within a matter of weeks, their memories improved dramatically. You're familiar with that one at all? Did you come across that?
I'm not familiar with that study, but it's very interesting. I mean, it seems to point in the same direction, that sleep is very necessary for whatever this purpose is. I mean, clearly one needs to take the brain offline so that it can perform this processing. And if you don't take it offline, then the system gets degraded.
Yeah, we've had Robert Stickold come on, who's a sleep specialist, and say that if you don't get a certain number of hours of sleep a night, and again, he's done it with his undergraduates, I think it's 7 was the magic number. You don't get 7 hours of sleep a night. You don't consolidate a lot of talents like playing an instrument, new kinds of things you want to learn, unless you get enough of that sleep at night. And it's certainly amazing how well he shows these things to happen in his laboratory. So anything from here, Nick? I know you're not the researcher on this. What, do you expect any follow-up to the brain? And is it possible to do this in people? We don't allow us to put our electrodes in our heads, but maybe on the outside in some way, non-invasive way.
Right. I mean, we allow electrodes if you have to go into the brain for some other reason, treat seizures or something, and then you have a few minutes in which you can put electrodes in. But I don't think you can yet do these recordings from the exterior of the brain. You need to put the electrodes right in. I think there will be lots of follow-ups, and this is just now that they have this handle, which is, you know, looking for these distinctive fast rewinds. I mean, this is a field of research they can take a long way. I think they can try and learn, well, exactly what is the nature of the dialogue between the hippocampus and the cortex, and is it a consolidation of memory, as you're suggesting, or is it the cortex trying to build up models and understanding of the outside world? I mean, the answers to these questions may be emerging for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you, Nick, for taking time to out of your busy schedule to be with us today in the holiday season. Have a happy holiday to you.
The same to you. Great to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you're welcome. Nicholas Wade is a science reporter at the New York Times, and he joined us today by phone. We're going to take a short break, switch gears, and come back and talk about more surprising research. This one is about a possible new malaria vaccine, which the researchers say it actually attacks the malaria inside the mosquito. And they think that there's a potential here, if it works, to wipe out malaria from whole geographic regions. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Talk about it lots more.